So here we are, and the system is broke. American dream has gone up in smoke. So stop sitting there all brokenhearted. Let's get this motherfucking party started. Lady Liberty is ringing a bell, and we're driving us straight into hell. But don't worry, we got what you need. Crank up the volume till your eardrums bleed. Go make America, America again.
Welcome everyone to the A Better Way to a Podcast. We are your hosts, Andrew and Jordan. I am Jordan. He is Andrew. Today, we are here with a very special guest, Kyle Clark from 9 News in Colorado. It is called 9 News, but it is in Colorado for those who do not live in Colorado, which is myself and Andrew and probably a decent portion of our listeners. Kyle popped up on our radar when the debates were going on, and he moderated the Republican debate in Colorado, and it was definitely not something that I was used to seeing. And I think that's what made you stick out. I think one of the biggest gripes that we have with modern debates, which I guess is a symptom of modern politics, is the fact that nobody really seems to hold these politicians accountable for their answers. And that was amazing watching you actually do a job as a moderator and pull people back.
So, something above and beyond a question asker, you know?
Yeah, it was nuts.
The crowd there.
Yeah, and we'll put a clip in it right here so you could see it.
So just to be clear, Ms. Boebert, you blame Republican voters for the fact that you nearly lost a safe seat and not your own conduct. You didn't make any attempt to answer the actual question, which is who should be doing this? It would be an unprecedented government action. Who should go into Windsor or to Parker?
If the federal government,
when you say federal agents, do you mean just Border Patrol, just ICE, or
National Guard, whatever it takes
that you wanted?
No, I didn't get a full House vote, and it was.
I apologize. This is going to be a long evening if you speak over the facts. Okay.
Do you
have any evidence to support that? Because our law enforcement has not put that forward. I'm just curious where you're getting that causation.
Just
about it. How would that work if the National Guard or the military were to come into Douglas County where you live and start rounding people up?
It's Mr. Holtorf,
Mr. Holtorf, you've been interrupting people constantly. I would ask you to stop. Ms. Flora, could you please answer the question?
Yes.
Bringing an out-of-state National Guardsman or the U.S. military in Douglas County, do you feel like that would work?
Not into Douglas County.
Move on. The question was about the actual work of rounding people up in Douglas County. We took a couple tries at that. Ms. Boebert, this session of Congress is on track to be one of the least productive in history in terms of the bills passed. Your Republican House colleague Andy Biggs said, "We have nothing to go out there and campaign on." Another House Republican, Chip Roy, said the Republican majority does not have one material, meaningful, significant accomplishment. That's what the Republicans are saying. What has the Republican majority in the House done about the price of groceries?
Probably what we need to do to begin
to... And how does that impact food prices? I'm sorry, I'm just trying to clarify.
When we are selling our resources...
Opportunity, if you would like to answer his question, which is the number of bills you've prime sponsored that have been signed by the president.
So my Pueblo Jobs Act has been signed into law.
A number, please.
That is one.
Got it.
I wish more debates were like that. And if more debates were like that, I think more people would watch them and people would actually...
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
I would love to start by talking about that because that was the first time that I had heard about you. When you went into this debate, did you go in with the intention of, you know, saying, okay, I'm not going to throw softballs. I'm going to hold these people accountable, did you just go into it, you know, with a set of questions to ask and hope for the best there?
So we do all of our debates in the same format, which is that we are looking to get voters useful information through a lens of accountability and also to kind of stress test the elected leaders and the people who want to run for office. You know, I've never been in elected office, but from covering it for more than a decade, I get the sense that their day-to-day is not just sitting there fending off softballs from people. They have like actual problems to solve, and they have to have tough conversations with people who don't always agree with them. And they're challenged on their views and their ideology. So my thought is that if the debate is one way for viewers to tell if people are prepared to hold office, that the debate should replicate some of the things that they might have to deal with in real life, right? Tough, pressing questions and difficult follow-ups and uncomfortable queries about things that they've said or done in the past, and that it shouldn't just be a parade of softballs. Because the other thing, too, is that candidates have a lot of venues where they get to get up, say whatever they want without scrutiny, and then they sit down to a polite golf clap, right? There's tons of places where that can be done. I don't think the televised debate should be a place where that happens.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you.
100%. You weren't like making a special point to do it this time. This is what you always do.
Oh yeah, no. This is the deal, right? This is the deal when we do debates on Nine News, and it's been that way for a long time. Just because, again, there's so many candidate forums and opportunities to appear at community events. I mean, heck, they can buy a TV ad and say whatever they want for 30 or 60 seconds. That's not the point of what we're trying to do. We're trying to show people, can they reconcile contrast between one another? Can they account for times they've changed their views? Because, right, sometimes the media falls into this trap that if you've changed your view, you're a flip-flopper. There's something inherently wrong with that. Show me somebody who has never changed their mind about anything over the course of a lifetime, and that person is either pretty, you know, doctrinaire or they're pretty dull, right? Everybody changes their mind with new information. So when somebody has changed their mind or they appear to have held two positions, I want to explore that as a journalist, not as a gotcha moment, but like a tell me more about how you got there, because that can be super illuminating when somebody running for elected office says, I used to believe that, and now I believe this. That can be really interesting.
Right.
I think that's one of the things that people really need to get used to or get back to, because, you know, I know myself, I've spoken about it ad nauseum on this podcast, that I used to believe very different things 10, 15 years ago, and now I don't. And that's okay. When you're presented with new information, you should take that new information and, you know, reanalyze your position. That's just the way that it's supposed to be. Your scientific method, we all learned it in middle school. You know, you have a hypothesis about the world, and you go and test that hypothesis. And if it's not the way that you thought it was, then you have to retest it with different variables. Like, that's the way that it works. But I agree with you. It's very rare to see politicians nowadays who are open about the mistakes they've made in the past, open about views that they've held in the past that are different than the ones that they hold now. And I really don't think it helps with this tribal mentality that we have politically, you know, where people are just like, this is what I believe, and this is it. This is the camp I'm in, and anyone in that camp is bad.
Yeah, all we in the media, we set up these perverse incentives, though, as the media, that changing your mind is bad. That changing your position is bad. So we in the media have to own our role and our responsibility in setting up that set of incentives that leans people toward this idea of you have one view for life. Now, this is not to say, because there are certainly some elected officials that are like, well, I'll take whatever position is convenient to me now. And, you know, who cares why I changed my position? Did I used to have that position? I don't remember that. This is what we're doing today, right? Viewers can see through that too. Voters can see through that too. But man, when somebody is thoughtful and they say, you're not going to believe this, but for 20 years, I was pretty sure that it worked like this. And then I met so-and-so, or I read this, or I learned this, and now I've come to learn it's actually this way. Or it's so complicated, I'm not sure yet. I love I'm not sure from a politician. There's a dude running for Denver mayor. We had something like 26 people running for mayor. We had a debate in which we had, how many people did we have on that stage? I think we had 13 people on a stage. It was an absolutely wild debate. But there was a guy running for mayor named Al Gardner, and I love that he was one of the first politicians or aspiring politicians I've ever interviewed who, to a number of my questions, said, that's a really difficult issue, and a bunch of smart people have tried to solve it, and I don't know that I have the answer. But I think I want to get these people in the room together and work on it, but I can't promise you an answer to this. Talking about issues, you know, like homeless, like how to deal with mass migration, things like that. But he didn't come in and BS and be like, I'm the savior who's going to solve everything. He was just like, you know, I'm good at convening people to solve issues.
Well, or even worse, you know, talking around the topic for 2 minutes and not answering the question, which I love that you did that, where there were multiple times where in the debate, the candidates would do that. And then at the end, you would essentially say, okay, well, you didn't answer the question, but maybe we can come back to that at another time. Why do you think more debates aren't like that? Because to me, that's exactly what people want to see. I think inherently we all believe that our politicians are lying to us. You know, I'm sure more or less, depending on which camp you're in and who you, how far into that camp you are. But I don't think people call them out for lacking the transparency that we all wish that they would have. And I think more debates like that would really get people more engaged in politics. So why do you think that's not the norm?
That's a very good question. I don't want to cast aspersions on journalists who conduct debates in different ways, but I think there's a variety of motivations. I think some journalists don't believe that that's the way a debate should be conducted. They just have a different view of how it should be done, maybe one that hews more traditional. I think some journalists would like to hold debates with more accountability, more fact-checking, but they work for people who won't allow it. I work for people who encourage us to take that approach. I think there may be some journalists who feel like it's not polite to interrupt somebody or to say, you didn't answer my question. But I'm there as a representative of the voter. I'm not there to get answers for me. I'm there to get answers for them. So I try to interrupt when they would interrupt. I try to redirect when they would redirect and try to say, you know, hey, man, that wasn't an answer to the question, if that's something that they would say. I would also add that doing a debate like that with the instant fact checking and with the redirects and with the anticipation of their three most commonly offered answers, it's kind of a pain in the ass to prepare for. Like it's a lot of work. You know what I mean? Going in with 10 questions and saying, I'm going to ask these 10 questions and no matter what spills out of their mouth hole, I'm just going to sit there, nod, smile and ask the next question. You can prepare for one of those debates really, really quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, the instant fact-checking is something that it's really interesting to me because how I mean, I'm sure you have people off camera that are Googling things like that, but is that essentially what it works? You just have a bunch of interns that are just furiously typing away, you know, into Google trying to figure out if what they're saying is accurate?
I wish. And maybe someday we'll have like an AI assistant that could do that and then talk into my earpiece.
You can't trust it.
I can't trust the AI.
It's lying to you too.
It only knows what it's been given. No, it's whatever I know going into the debate. It's whatever preparation I've done ahead of time. Yeah. So I mean, my goal is to anticipate their responses, anticipate their talking points, then fact check those ahead of time so that then when they offer a response, I know, oh, this accords with the truth, or they're leaving out key context that I should add, or this is intentionally deceptive, and I thought they'd go there, so I'm prepared in those ways. So yeah, so it's either, you know, it's what's in my head or on the paper in front of me, and what I come in with is what I come in with. The only communication that comes into my ear during a debate through our earpiece is, you have this much time remaining.
That's a really interesting idea, you know, like a concept for like a way of conducting an interview, where you ask a factual question and you know the answer already. You're not actually looking for the answer. You're looking for the difference between the factual answer and what this person is going to say.
Nailed it. Yep. Because it's very, very rare to learn about policy positions during a debate. Occasionally, you can learn about new policy positions because most of the time, those things have already been fleshed out elsewhere. I'm interested in, what can we learn about a person's character? What can we learn about a person's commitment to accountability and transparency? What can we learn about how they treat other people? What can we learn about how they respond when challenged? Those are the things to me that come out in a debate.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Do you think that things are uniquely bad now with the way that politics has become so tribalized with politicians?
Like a lack of trust in
perception of politicians being dishonest and saying whatever they need to say to get elected. Do you think things are uniquely bad now, or do you think things have been like this forever?
So you know, recency.
I say perception for
recency,
a reason.
Like, yeah, I mean, so recency bias always tells us that whatever is front of our memory is more important or better or worse, right? But that said, I do think it's worse now. And the reason why I think that it's worse now is because there's such an active effort being made to undermine the idea of the existence of truth. That to me is uniquely corrosive in modern American history to the time that we're in, where there were always people who would lie and deceive, but they would lie and deceive to tell people, didn't know, this is the truth. Come over here and join me in this truth. And now there's a bit of like, truth? Who the hell cares, baby? That, I think, is somewhat unique to this moment. That's highly corrosive. Yeah. And not to take too serious of a turn on this, I talk a lot in our community here in Colorado and in Denver about the value of people living in a shared reality and accepting truth, even when it doesn't necessarily make them feel great about their own worldview. Because when you don't live in a shared reality, that's when really, really ugly things have happened in human history. I think we look back through history and we say, how could those people have done that, right? And sometimes people will say, well, they're evil. I think that's a cop-out. They believed untrue things about other people. It's easy to say they were evil, they were stupid, they were whatever, you know. No, they genuinely believed very dangerously untrue things about other people and then acted rationally on untrue things.
Yeah, I really appreciate you saying that, because that's something that we've harped on multiple times on this podcast, on social media and whatnot. You know, one of the things that I see far too often is people othering people in a way that makes it easy for them to justify negative emotions, justify negative actions towards them. And I see it from both sides, to be honest, but, you know, the stuff that we focus on, we see way more of it coming from the right. And what I generally tell people is, you know, you have to think about it from the perspective of you used to believe something different, hopefully, and now you don't. When you believed the thing that you used to believe, you thought you were right until you came across new information that caused you to change your mind.
Yeah.
We've talked about Daryl Davis on the show before. Daryl Davis going across the country to meet Klans members who, you know, hated black people. Daryl Davis is a jazz musician and author, and he would go to talk to these people. And I think he collected something like over 100 robes from these Klansmen who, after meeting him and speaking with him, were like, I guess I'm not racist, because the things that I had thought were incorrect.
He took this huge gamble where he's like, I think that the reason these people are saying this thing is because they've never been confronted with the truth. And, you know, he risked his like life and safety to show them that truth, you know, and, you know, time and time again, he was rewarded with, you know, actually tangibly changing these people's worldview. And you can't ask everybody to do that, but I mean, that's just like insane to show that it's like, you know, it's a great example of why like arguing with people sometimes can entrench them in their positions, but just like interacting with people in good faith can make huge changes.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I was just going to say,
we have a weeknight news program on 9 News here in Denver called Next that we started 8 years ago that blends news reporting, analysis, and commentary. And when we brought commentary back to local television, where it was for a very long time, like if you look at like the 70s and 80s, there's a lot of commentary on local TV. And when we brought it back, we specifically told people, we don't want to do this in the cable news model in which people come to hear things that they agree with and to get mad at the other side. We want to do commentary that reminds people, neighbors, right? Because we're local television, that reminds neighbors what they have in common when they disagree. So if you watch our commentary, a lot of it is through that lens where I appeal to the people who naturally would believe an argument or would support someone or a position and say, but hey, what they're doing is not in line with your professed values. And what we do is we advocate not for ideology. We don't advocate for policy, but we advocate for shared community values like honesty and transparency and accountability. But it's through that lens of, you agree with your neighbors more than you think that you do. And it's an intentional effort on our part to counteract what I believe local broadcast news has done a lot of for 50 years, which has made people scared as hell of their neighbors, that what is outside the door is dangerous and that these people want to hurt you and harm you, and the world is this terrible, dangerous place. Yeah. Stay inside by the warming glow of the television, and we will keep you safe. Right?
And I think I'm your only friend, and yeah, I'm in the TV.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And you know, but then watch out, because there's something in your fridge that might kill you. We'll tell you tonight at 10. And it's like, oh no, my fridge too? You know, my neighbors want to kill me outside. Now something in my fridge wants to kill me. And I think
more likely than you think.
Yeah. But there's been this idea that like, that's just television. That's show business, baby. That's how you get people to watch. And it's like, or marinating our society in that for 50 years warps people's view of their neighbors and has real detrimental effects on the world. And we have to take responsibility for that. And I think some of that just starts with reminding people, you have a lot in common with your neighbors, even if you disagree on what are called the issues, right? What are the issues, right? It's whatever mass media, culture, politicians tell you that we should be arguing about. But you have way more shared interests with your neighbors than you think you do. And we try to remind people of that and hopefully sew them together, because we cannot tear people against each other and tell people that you don't just disagree with your neighbor, but they're evil and they're out to get you, and then expect people not to act on that, right? I mean, tell me that the man across the street disagrees with me, I'm going to go have a conversation with him. Tell me that he's evil and he wants to harm my wife and kids, and all of a sudden the action spectrum changes.
Yeah.
So we got to be real careful about what we're doing. And I say we, it's anybody who has a microphone.
No, like the society in general. I'm going to take a tangent here. Do you guys remember Edgar Welch, the Pizzagate guy?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. He just got shot to death by cops in North Carolina. You know, it was, I mean, not an unforeseen outcome. But like, here's a guy, like, you could consider this dude like a weirdo, violent scumbag. But like, I really feel like this is a guy that society has failed. Because, you know, you're talking about like, believing untrue things and acting rationally on untrue beliefs. You know, he justified what he did in DC by, you know, he wanted to save children. You know, if there was like a child sex ring in a basement in DC, you know,
that it makes sense.
Yeah. What he did makes sense. Yeah. Right.
But
of course that's bullshit. And it's always been bullshit. And everybody but him knew it was bullshit.
Well, to be fair, there was a group of people that believed.
Right. But I mean, even some of them probably knew it was bullshit, right? And they were just like having fun talking about it on the internet. And here's a guy with a thin grasp on reality. They got, you know, whipped up into a frenzy about it. And obviously he had other shit going on, because he's got a number of, you know, he died in a traffic stop over an outstanding warrant for, you know, parole violation or something like that. But like, you know, there are people out there that might otherwise live normal lives without confrontation and without violence if there wasn't this like miasma of like misinformation and confrontation being whipped up, you know, by, you know, this like entertainment nexus of politicians and big media corporations.
Yeah. Lies ruin lives. And sometimes they ruin the life of the liar. We had a situation out here in Colorado with a county election clerk, Tina Peters, who became convinced by the MyPillow guy and others that elections were being flipped by the voting machines.
Yeah.
So she worked with conspiracy theorists to sneak a guy in to illegally make copies of what was inside the voting systems. In years of talking with Tina Peters, she truly believes what she says. She's now in jail and she's headed for state prison. And I think she got 8 or 9 years. Those lies ruined her life. And it put the lives of other elections workers in Colorado in danger, who now do their work behind bulletproof glass, because other people who believe those lies are willing to act. And this is where it kind of gets tough, because somebody can clip this and take it out of context. But people who are willing to act rationally based on the lies, like, truly, if American democracy was being stolen by multinational corporations through machines, a lot of Americans would rise up violently to stop that. It's not, right? That's make-believe. That's fantasy that people who don't believe it are using to gain power themselves without thinking, what happens if somebody goes and acts rationally yet violently based on the lies that I've told them? This stuff ruins lives and it can take lives.
We've constantly come up against this specifically. So our whole premise, the whole reason A Better Way to A started was to promote the idea that gun rights are for everybody, because we're in the same boat as far as like every right for everyone all the time. I think that's a liberal gun club motto, but we came out of the gate saying gun rights are for everyone. We did not say gun rights are for everyone, but we're really going to focus on arming trans people. But what happened was when we said gun rights are for everyone, a whole bunch of transphobes came out of the woodwork and were like, well, what about pedophiles? You support arming pedophiles? Yeah. Because they're using the term synonymously with trans people because of the things that they've been told.
Yeah.
These made up statistics. And as a result, we push back harder. And, you know, we have trans friends. Between Andrew and I, we've got multiple friends who are trans who also happen to be gun owners.
Yeah. So we just spend this inordinate amount of time specifically defending trans gun owners.
Yeah,
and their rights.
You know, it's such a small part of what we do, but because it takes up so much of our time, because that is what consumes people out in the ether. In the comment section. Yeah, well, it's turned into this you know, this like identifiable trait of A Better Way to A now, where I'll see in comment sections that are, you know, just way too toxic to be in. Like, you've got to put on like a radiation suit to hang out in for too long. They'll be like, oh, these guys support A Better Way to Gay. Those guys like arming pedophiles and it's like, it's so goofy. But I think where I was going with this, I apologize for the tirade, was that people acting violently in defense of rational fears, the kid excuse has come up multiple times over the past few decades.
And it's so alarming because it's like, you know, everyone wants to defend kids, right? Everyone kids wants are defenseless. To defend kids.
So but when you hate something enough and you somehow spin it to say, okay, well, this is going to harm the kids, because that's, you know, the trans bathroom thing. Well, it's if I see a man going into a bathroom with my kid, nobody's going to, like, no, if somebody wants to do something bad to a kid, they don't have to put on a dress to do it. People do illegal things all the time as normal presenting, like, or I should say, like, traditional presenting straight cis men. And, you know, it's the kids. It was the same thing with metal music. It was the same thing with violent video games. It was, you know, it's time and time again. And now you've got people who are going and protesting drag shows because it's culminated in this, you know, armed protests against drag shows, shooting transformers to knock out power to city blocks to prevent them from going on, because they believe that their kids are in danger. And like you said, you know, if you think the democracy is at stake and people are stealing elections, then it makes sense to go out and do something abnormal. But it just goes to show you that, you know, the media has a lot of responsibility, and it's very refreshing hearing you acknowledge that. And I knew, you know, this is why we wanted you on the show. I, you know, just seeing some of the stuff that you talked about, I knew we were going to be on the same page with a lot of stuff, even if we disagree with some other things, I'm sure, because we're human. These kind of conversations are really the kind of things that I wish we had more of, and especially had more of with people who are in the media, because I think it's super important.
Well, and I think everything you're talking about there just reinforces, like, facts matter. The truth matters, because what people believe has real consequences. And I think sometimes we can get so caught up in talking about people's reactions to their beliefs and, you know, how do we legislate public safety, and, you know, then we get into, like, you know, legislating, you know, what people can say and people can believe. I mean, you talk about the idea that rights are for everybody. You know, I operate off, you know, off free speech rights, you know, which are also for everybody, right? And whenever somebody says, well, except those people, it's like, well, hold on now. And I think, you know, what people forget is, like, you know.
Or those aren't people.
Right, yeah, yes, we're going to section off
the big
people,
one.
Yeah, but we're going to section off these folks as and say that they should not have rights. You know, free speech rights, of course, does not, you know, prevent you from reaping the consequences of your abhorrent views. Right.
Right.
You know, so a lot of times
or shield that, you from criticism.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. You know, a lot of times it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I exercised my free speech rights and now I'm suffering consequences. Yes. Yes, indeed.
That's yeah. because, yeah.
Because would that you is believe life. That other people also life. Have First Amendment rights?
Yeah, you do not have a right to be free of criticism or consequences for sharing your views. It's just we're not going to put you in jail for saying it, right? But I think anytime we get into that territory where it's like, well, this right or that right is for this person, but not for these folks that I don't like, that gets into really dangerous territory. But to the broader point, the more that we can do both inside and outside journalism to encourage people to live in a shared reality is just so vitally important, because I don't think that most people are crazy and I don't think that they're evil. I think they make the best possible decisions they can based on the information that they have.
I agree with that so much. I really do think, and this is just part of my like philosophy in politics, I think that most people are basically good. I think that like people sometimes make bad decisions, you know, from my perspective, I guess. And especially people in large groups can make some really silly decisions as a group. But I really do believe that most people, even people I disagree with, are basically good and trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting because I think so much of our lives are consumed by politics now. And because I'm a political reporter, I think sometimes people think, well, you must have really strong political views. And it's interesting. I sometimes compare it to like a sportscaster, somebody who covers sports. Like when it becomes your job, it is your job, right? And the sportscasters are not there at games cheering for the team that they like. You know, their motivation is to tell you what's going on and to provide you insight and analysis on what's going on. And that becomes a lot more important than what they personally believe. So people say, you know, you cover politics, you must have really strong political views. And it's interesting, the more I cover politics, the less strong my political views have become, because it's very immaterial to my work, right? I mean, I have biases because every human being has biases. So until we're all replaced with AI and robots, you're going to have journalists with biases and doctors with biases and teachers with biases, right? Because that's how it works. We're humans, but we try to counteract our biases. But to the extent that I have a philosophy about life or politics, having been steeped in it for so long, I don't know. It more and more, it seems to come down to, for me, you know, if people aren't hurting anybody, why don't we leave them alone? And the thing we do have to keep an eye out for is people with power mistreating people without power. And that has no tether, right, to ideology, right? The accumulation and use of power and people who are stripped of power and who don't have power, that's irrespective of ideology. But as long as that dynamic exists, there have to be checks and balances. And that speaks to everything from journalism to public safety to education. How do we keep proper checks and balances between the people who have power and people who don't have power?
I think that idea, like obviously, like as an approach to policy is really powerful. But I think that idea is actually pretty universal in sort of like a psychosocial context. And I think that that's probably why, I don't know why this specific debate that District 4 debate in November, why that went viral, even though that's like your normal thing, like you always do that. I might just be sort of like a time and place thing. But I think that's what resonates about that so much, is that it's like, here's one context where we can see on television these people with power kind of like getting, you know, somebody like putting the brakes on for them.
I think it is absolutely time and place. And I think there was a hunger for it in the presidential race. And when people saw it in a congressional race, they latched onto it. I think what they saw in the presidential race is you had a diminished president in office who clearly could not handle a lot of pressing questions in difficult situations. And people were frustrated that he was being protected by his party, or if they felt like people in the press were enabling him and protecting him. And on the other side of the ledger, you had a Republican candidate who was often untethered from truth and consequences and was free to just say or do whatever he wanted in his life. And people felt like there wasn't good accountability on either of those two men at that moment. So I think that might have been why people latched onto and liked our debate style.
And was it frustrating to you, given Lauren Boebert's really abysmal performance in that debate, which, I mean, that might be a little bit subjective, but given how difficult a time she had with that debate, was it frustrating to you that she went on to win so handily that election?
election outcomes are never frustrating or encouraging for me. They are what they are, right? They're like the outcome of a sports game in the sense that I'm not saying that politics in our elections are a game, but my role is that of a sports writer. I'm supposed to analyze what's in front of us and look at it. I've covered Lauren Boebert for years, right? Before she was ever running for elected office, right? I mean, I think some of my first coverage of her happened when she confronted Beto O'Rourke outside the Aurora City Hall, when she drove across the state to go to that protest and say, "You're not going to take my guns." Right. That's when Lauren Boebert popped up on my radar. And I was like, oh, who's she? Oh, she runs this gun restaurant in Rifle where everybody's strapped. I was like, oh, OK, that's interesting. All right. Like that kind of tracks with that community. I get why that's popular. And then she starts to build a profile for herself. And when she launched her first run for Congress, I watched the way that it was catching fire in some far right circles when she launched her primary against Scott Tipton, who was kind of like white paint on a wall, right? I mean, like, you know, you don't notice he's there until unless somebody says he's there, right? But she launched her primary against him, and I was like, I think this could go somewhere. And we had her in the very next day for my one and only extended sit-down interview with her, in which it became pretty clear that, one, she didn't understand how Congress functioned. She was mad that Scott Tipton was not chairing a committee that she turned on television, and I had to explain to her he wasn't chairing the committee because Democrats were in control of the House. So they ran the committee and he was the vice chair of the committee. But it was also clear to me that she was tapping into a discontent and was telling people, I don't like Congress. I don't even really know how Congress works, but send me there and I'm going to fight with people. And yeah, I think a lot of folks in Colorado were like, yeah, let's do some of that. And to her credit, she's done exactly what she said she was going to do. Now, that said, she wore out her welcome with a considerable portion of people who live on Colorado's western slope. This is a solidly Republican district, and she nearly lost to a centrist Democrat in Adam Frisch. And then she moved across the state, moved up and over the mountains, down the other side, to go and move into the safest Republican seat in the state, because she was likely to lose her old seat if she ran again against the same guy. Because they were tired up. So she moves into the safest Republican seat. Interestingly, a good number of Republicans in that district didn't take too kindly to that. But she had enough of a following that she quite handily won that race. Now, she went on to win the general election again in Colorado's safest Republican congressional seat. She won it in the general election by half the margin of her predecessor in his last two wins. I believe he won it by 24 points both times. She won it by 12. Am I predicting that she's going to make that seat competitive? No, because a 24-point Republican edge is an enormous edge. But you put her in front of that electorate, and it was halved. It was a 12-point edge.
Yeah, that definitely says something.
No, absolutely. I wish people were more critical of the people that they had in front of them. And I see these political ads that, you know, we're out of election season now. And I'm just so glad, because preface this, like when I'm at work, there's usually a TV on in the background, and it's usually on Story Television, which is like the old History Channel. And it's like old people TV. So there's constantly like Prevagen commercials for like memory loss. There's constantly like AARP stuff. And the political ads are rampant. So I'm just so glad that we're outside of the election season and we don't have to see those anymore. But I couldn't help when those commercials would come on to like, I had this internal screaming, just like it just like in my brain, whenever these commercials would come on, because the things that they would say were just blatant, incontextual lies. Like there would say these, I mean, I don't need to explain political attack ads to you, but seeing someone like Lauren Boebert fall from grace, so to say, is refreshing, because to me, it shows that people are paying attention and realizing they're not getting what they paid for, essentially. And I want that kind of critical thinking to stick moving forward.
And to fight this like anti-intellectual push of like, I mean, it's kind of like what you were saying, Kyle, where Lauren Boebert is like, I don't know how Congress works, and that's why you should vote for me. You know, and I see.
Well, it's
this,
why Trump won. I'm not a politician. Vote for me.
I see this all, you know, in every subject of public policy, in every race, there's always this idea that it's like, you know, sometimes knowing how a thing works is like a moral violation, you know, and like being an expert politician is like actually a mark of shame, and you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't know how this works. You know,
talked about this with guns. You know, anti-gun organizations seem to thrive on being ignorant on the actual topic of firearms or firearms laws,
like the mechanics,
crime statistics.
Or
just in general, just it's a very emotionally based thing. And when you start to learn about firearms, it's almost like they start looking at you funny. Like, why are you doing that?
Whereas why wouldn't we value the people who are trying to legislate about firearms being the most knowledgeable about firearms or any other issue? No, that's very interesting, because that comes up in a lot of Colorado's debates about gun control, which we have on an annual basis out here with our legislature. Yeah. And the starting point, I feel like, of so many of these discussions is people within the gun rights community saying, do you have any concept of the unintended consequences that this legislation will cause? And so there's always kind of like this ramp up around education of like, what are you trying to do? Will this do what you think it is going to do? And what are the unintended consequences? And I feel like, you know, we're very early in our legislative session, but last year they tried to do a ban on so-called assault weapons. It failed. But it got further than it has in the past. This year, what the Dems are going after is a ban on the sale or manufacture of semi-autos with detachable magazines, they are saying
that's wild,
right? That's huge, huge scope. Like,
that's so many guns,
incredibly wide ranging, right? But what they're going to try to do this time around is say that it's not a gun ban, but it's a way to enforce Colorado's large mag ban, which stores have been getting around for years by selling mags and parts. So they're not selling you the magazines, they're selling you the parts of the magazine, you put it together at home. So now they're saying, well, actually the way to enforce that large magazine ban is to ban semi-autos with detachable magazines. So we'll see where that goes. We are in the opening week of the legislative session here, but I feel like so much of that, and right, you guys talk about guns, but this idea that like expertise should be a virtue and not a vice or not a demerit. And this idea that like knowing something is therefore elitism and therefore is bad. I think there's less of that around guns than there are a lot of issues. I think just because guns are so firmly established with the American right. But this idea that it's like, if you know about anything, well, then you're just an elitist who's preaching to us.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, no. Knowing things is good, right? Whether you know things about like business or agriculture or firearms or meteorology or anything, like knowledge is good. And if we say, well, that's elitism and we want to cast that aside, you know, then what's the Idiocracy? Like, you know, like that's where you're headed on things.
I love to talk to people that I disagree with about things when they know as much or more than I do. I find it really tiresome to debate something with somebody. Not that like debating is like an actual like fun activity, but you know, ever really like in a social context, but like I find it really irritating to have the same conversations with people who know very little about a thing. Sometimes it's guns or gun control. Sometimes it's other stuff. Where it's like, you know, okay, like if we're going to have this conversation, I have to go through this whole like set of like definitions first, you know? And then by the time their eyes are like glazing over and they're like, look, I just don't like the fucking thing. And I find it a lot better to have a conversation with somebody who already knows a lot, or maybe more than I do, and I can learn, you know, and it's been this way. I've had some like really good conversations about like healthcare and like health policy from people who know like a shit ton more than I do.
Andrew and I work so well together because I know so much more than he does, and I'm constantly teaching him things.
Yeah.
But isn't it fascinating, you know, though, to also have conversations with people and try to figure out whether their strongly held beliefs come from education on a topic or a lack of education 100%. On a topic, which does not invalidate anybody's opinion, right? Because anybody is allowed to have an opinion. But I want to know, like, how'd you get there? Did you get there experientially? Did you get there emotionally? Right. Did you get there educationally? I'll tell you, one of the coolest things about being a reporter is the fact that quite often we're generalists. And a lot of our day is spent calling knowledgeable people and saying, can you really quickly teach me about this? I mean, that's a lot of time. And it's so much fun, right? We have a license to call people, ask for their time to teach us about stuff so that we can then teach other people about it. And it's so interesting. We're so into this, you know, like debate me bro culture where it's like so often when you'll ask people for information, like the debate starts and you're like, no. I don't want to hear about your views. Teach me about the thing. Like, I want to know the underlying thing. Then teach me why what you know about it informs your beliefs. But we got to start with the fact set, right? And then that's what we try to take to the public, which is like, here's the fact set and here's what people believe about it. And the cheap and lazy way to do it is to start with what people believe about it and to never really delve into the fact set or to pretend like the fact set is up for dispute or that reality is up for dispute or we won't touch that or here's what this person says reality is and here's what the other person says reality is. No. Facts
or just
are facts.
To make stuff
reality
up.
Is reality. Yeah, or to make an invented reality. But we've got to have that fact set to operate off of. And like you said, I am way more interested in hearing the opinions of people whose beliefs are grounded in like experience and education than just I'm a really good debater and I've got strong feels about this.
Kyle, how do we make facts sexy again? Because
can I tell you? I have a thought.
Please.
You make facts sexy by acknowledging the facts that do not support your worldview. It's by people of good faith saying the best argument against my position is this because the following facts are inconvenient for what I believe. Now, I believe that there's a preponderance of other material that has led me to my core belief, but I acknowledge to you this, that's ugly. That's ugly for me. That's bad for our team. But man, I think there's other stuff out there that outweighs it. Whenever somebody says to me, I believe X, despite the fact that I acknowledge that Y happens,
right?
I put a lot of faith and credit in that person.
And this comes up for us when we start talking about suicide statistics, where it's like, you know, obviously one of our like favorite like refutations for like the firearm homicide rate is that like something like 2/3 of it at any given time is actually suicides annually.
Yeah.
But then it's like, okay, so the counter to that is
total deaths, not the homicide.
Yeah, right.
But just for the, you know, autists that are listening.
But like, then it's like, okay, so. Sorry, my son just opened the door. Hey, buddy, I'm sorry. I'm doing a podcast right now. I'll come out in just a minute. I love you
His kids are adorable. They're so sweet.
I love you so much.
If you'd put odds on whose kids would bust in and it's not mine singing the soundtrack of either Frozen or Moana, then that's good. I'll take anybody else's kids busting in other than mine.
How old are your daughters?
4 and 6.
Oh, okay. Mine is 2.5 and she is just getting into Moana and Frozen. So she's loving the sounds of the music.
Yeah, let a little dad tip here. The first Moana soundtrack really slaps, and in terms of Disney music, it doesn't get any better than that. So I was resistant to it at first, being played on my home, and then I realized how much better it was than the other soundtracks. And now it's like, no, you want to do Moana? Let's do Moana. Another tip: took the kids to Moana 2 last weekend. No, not ready for prime time.
No?
Not ready for prime time.
I heard the same thing. It's not as good.
Yeah, you know, but that was a high bar on the first one. But yeah, when they start to explore other soundtracks, try to steer them back to Moana because it's good stuff.
I just realized one of the downsides of using this app versus the other is that I cannot mute other people. Oh, thank you. Oh, he just muted himself. I felt so bad doing it, but yeah, you know, we could talk kid stuff for forever. We had an episode where it was just Andrew and I, and we were talking kid stuff right as I had my first, our only kid. And it resonated with a lot of guys specifically because I was very open about my initial feelings on having a kid. But
what were those?
It was rough. I never had the urge. I never had the excitement that a lot of people said that I was going to have when she was born. I was never excited for the whole pregnancy. I just never had that emotion. And then when she was born, everybody said, you know, oh, you're going to fall in love immediately. And that didn't happen.
Yep.
It was like, yep. No, how do I take care of my wife? She's uncomfortable. And I, you know, you've got this thing now that doesn't give you any feedback, doesn't, you know, show any affection or anything like that. It was very tough for me. And that was something that nobody prepared me for. And I thought, you know, what the fuck is wrong with me? Why don't I immediately love this kid? Why am I not in love with this kid? Now she's my best friend. But that was something that, you know, and I was open about it. And I got a lot of really positive feedback from people saying, you know, that's something that I never knew was a thing until I heard you talk about it. And then I Googled it and realized that it's like half of men.
Yep.
It's just not something that people talk about because go figure, guys don't like talking about their feelings. So when they feel something that's not the norm, we don't talk about it. Yes.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's funny you say that. And I'm glad that you've talked about it publicly, because I don't know that I've ever talked about publicly the fact that I went through the same thing with our first. I talk about it with other expecting dads, with friends. I'll tell them all the time, you know, like, you know, based on my experience, the first 6 to 9 months of your kid's life, you know, the rewards are for mom. They're not for you. They weren't there for me.
Yeah.
They weren't there for me. At about the 9 month mark, they started to come with some of the reaction, some of the response. And I don't know how much of that is me, how much of that is just biology, but I felt very disconnected at first as a dad. But then when the rewards come, then it's just like, oh my goodness. And that, then you understand how people are
huge.
Into it. And you know, I'm envious of the guys, you know, and maybe this is like bullshit Instagram culture, but like, you know, that instant bond stuff, you know, that you always see everywhere. And it's like, and you know, guys are taught to expect that. And like, maybe that is for some people. It wasn't for me. Like my whole thing, very similar to you, was like, my wife just did this incredible thing and she's made a human, and like, what do we need to do to keep the human safe and keep her safe? But it was like, it was the tiny roommate thing. It was like, we've got this tiny roommate and I mean, she's cool, right? Like that's fine. She's here. It's cool. But it did take like 9 months for it to be like, oh, now I understand. And then, you know, for fully like the protector instinct to kick in and to be like, I would give my life for that kid. Right. Like, and then, then you're down the rabbit hole.
What? Yeah. 100%. I said for the longest time, like to me, it feels like I just have another pet, except it's like a hamster, because the hamster doesn't run up to me when I got home, like all that stuff, you know. It's just, there's no emotion. There's no positive feedback. It's all just like, it's a blob, you know, and it cries and poops and pees and stuff like that. And then, I got really drunk one night with my wife's blessing. I had Chinese food and I had a fortune cookie, which I think are bullshit, but it just right place, right time kind of thing.
Yeah.
It said your best friend was once a stranger, and I kept it. I like bawled my eyes out when I read that, because it was the most taxing thing in our life at that point, was the fact that I did not feel connected to this baby. And it was that little bit of like, you're going to be okay, which is, you know, it was complete bullshit, fortune cookies. It was just the fact that it was the little bit of perspective that gave me, and it was all over, you know, after that.
Yeah, no, that's interesting that like, that was the thing. I don't know. I mean, that, unsolicited parenting advice, right, is the worst
Give
thing
it.
In the world. No, I'll just say.
Oh, yeah.
So my parents who are great parents have not given me parenting advice at all. And which is strange, right? Because they were great parents. So like they know that I think that they're great parents. So like you would think that'd be very receptive to it. But the one thing that my mother said that has just stuck with me, and it's the only thing that I ever tell other parents in terms of perspective, is just, you know, the best days don't last and the worst days don't last. So enjoy the good. Don't let the bad bring you down, because everything is over in a flash. Every stage, every phase is over in a flash. So if you love it, dive in and enjoy it, because it won't last. And if it bothers you, it'll pass. You know, so
that is great advice. I wanted to circle back, because I know we're getting to the hour mark. But this is a really good question that I'm saying it's a really good question. I didn't write it. I'm not tooting my own horn. Our friend Kenny, who's like a godsend when it comes to like our chaotic lives, and he helped us out and wrote us a few questions. Talking about responsibility of the media, and especially with the gun stuff that we were talking on earlier, it seems to be that news organizations have come to see, I know this is like such a hard break from what we were just talking about, but have come to see suicide as a almost contagious, and they handle coverage of it very carefully. Do you see a parallel between suicide and mass shootings in terms of contagiousness or copycat actors? Because that's one of the things that I feel like they've interviewed mass shooters before who have said that they were inspired by XYZ mass shooter. But it feels like, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. And every time there's a mass shooting, as awful as it is, and obviously, you know, the responsibility that the media has to balance giving the public information with maintaining a semblance of safety, it feels like we're not helping ourselves when we plaster a mass shooter on TV for a week long or for a week straight, depending on the severity of it. Do you think that there is anything that the media should be doing differently than it is currently doing right now in the way that it handles mass shootings?
It's a great question. I'll start with the beginning of what you said, and then I'll turn to the end of what you said. In terms of suicide and mass shooting, right, I think we have to acknowledge that a number of mass shootings are a form of suicide, right?
For sure.
You know, what changed my perspective on it was after I covered the Aurora Theater shooting here in Colorado, I got to know Tom and Karen Teeves, whose son Alex was killed in the theater. And I think I connected with them in a way because Alex and I seemed like we were a lot alike. We were right about the same age. We were into some of the same stuff. We frequented some of the same breweries around town. You know, I would talk with his mom about, you know, like, I wonder if we ever like sat next to each other at the bar and like, you know, and never even, you know, it didn't track or didn't, you know, come up in memory or whatever. But Tom and Karen became really staunch proponents of the idea of no notoriety for mass shooters, which at first as a journalist, I kind of bristled at because it's like, well, our job is to tell you the truth. And like the name is the truth and the person's story is the truth. And, you know, we can't hide these things. And the more I talked to them, I realized that they weren't interested in absolutes. They understood nuance. What they were asking for was improvement and intelligence and lead into a code that most journalists subscribe to, which involves minimizing harm. And it doesn't say, you know, do no harm, because if we're being honest, right, there journalism does do harm to people. You know, if somebody's embezzling money and we point it out, yes, you know, we're doing good for the organization, the people hurt, but we're also doing harm to the embezzler, right? That person's life is going to take a turn.
Yeah.
Sometimes telling the truth does harm. But what they said with no notoriety is, you know, you all ascribe to a code to minimize harm, so minimize harm. If these shooters want attention, don't give it to them. And what I think is sensible is the approach that Nine News and a number of other media outlets have. And I think sometimes the closer you are to these repeat tragedies, I think in Colorado, obviously Columbine colors a lot of what the media does out here because of how poorly the media handled the Columbine shooting. And a lot of that was how the national media handled Columbine, the way that they treated that community and those families, and then left town. And it was local journalists who were left to pick up the pieces over the next generation, mistrust and mistreatment. And I think since then, obviously, we've had a number of shootings, from the Aurora Theater shooting to the STEMS school shooting to the Deer Creek school shooting and so forth. But after Aurora, the Teeves said, you know, consider no notoriety and consider if you could help us lessen the instances of these in the future. And what I subscribe to is the idea of, in the initial moments after a mass shooting, I think it is important to put the shooter's name and face out there because we have to figure out who else in the community knows something. And in that information gathering phase, it is important for that to be out there. But to me, it very, very quickly should morph to the shooter, the killer. That tells people all that they need to know about that person. If for some reason they don't know who the person is, that information is easily accessible online. But we quickly shift to that and put the focus on the victims so that other people out there who might have some little tickle in the brain that this could be a road that they go down, quickly see they're not even going to say my name. They're not going to say my name. You know, I heard from the father of a young girl who was killed in a shooting in a school years ago. And this was something that happened 10 years ago in town. But we were mentioning when it came up on the 1 year mark or the date in the calendar, you know, talked about her and her life and mentioned, you know, that, you know, the shooter whose name doesn't matter was killed by law enforcement that day. And her father reached out to me and he goes, I had never heard somebody say on air that his name doesn't matter. And I was like, yeah, I wasn't really sure if I should say that, but that's what I thought. And I have a show where I'm allowed to say what I think. So I said that. And he goes, you'll never know how much that meant. So wow. I think the ability to also send that message when we can, that not only will your name not be said, but it won't matter. It won't matter. And what you do will only matter in the sense that you will hurt people. You're not going to get a message out. You're not going to change the world. You're going to hurt people. And your name and your story isn't going to matter. And there will be some mass shooters in Colorado whose names and faces, you know, you can't forget and whose stories you can't forget. But anytime I think back on a shooting and I can't remember the shooter's name or can't remember the shooter's motivation, maybe this makes me a bad journalist, but I kind of nod my head and I'm like, yep. If I need to know, I can look it up.
Yeah. I think that's a very balanced approach to the topic because it is tough. You know, you have a job where you have a duty to inform people. And I had never thought about it like that as far as the initial incident, you know, with the fact finding and trying to gather as much information as possible. Name and faces is a very important piece of information to put out there. But yeah, no, I think that's a long way from, you know, these organizations that'll put out the shooter's manifesto on their channel for the
oh my god, I know.
Weeks to come. And it's just, and
they're like, you know, how do we make this guy that did this horrible thing look as cool as possible?
Yeah,
which is like,
I also think, you know, and that this is not what the Teeves family or No Notoriety has asked for, but I also think that it's important that we don't swing so hard in the other direction that we refuse to ever talk about the shooter or to initially say their motivation, because then it becomes the forbidden fruit, right? Then it becomes the thing that people will seek out. And there's always going to be an aspect of that, right? And there's a tremendous aspect to this day around the Columbine killers and like that kind of cult-like fascination. And I don't want us to get to a point as a media and a culture where we are so opposed to ever having the name or face out there that it becomes something that people seek out, you know, because they don't want you to know. No, if you want to know,
what are they hiding?
Yeah. What I'm telling you is it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And that person and their motivations does not matter, because all they caused was hurt and harm. But if you want to go look it up, knock yourself out, bud. You know, like, do your thing. We can't put it in a black box, because then I think we're going to create another issue.
Yeah.
Right. Really, and great. Like, most importantly, like, we do need to talk about why these things happen, but we have to acknowledge that, like, the specific motivations of an individual killer don't really have a great deal of effect on whether the thing would have happened or not. You know,
We do need to look at, right, you know, who else in the community might be motivated to act on the same ideology, right? We need to look at that. And then we need to look at what opportunities were missed to help the person deal with whatever they were dealing with that unresolved led them to this action. Like the most recent example of this that we have in Colorado, not a mass shooting, but the Green Beret from Colorado Springs who shot himself and blew up that Cybertruck outside the Trump property in Las Vegas. You know, there's somebody who served our country. He was highly decorated. Something went wrong, and he decided that that's what he was going to do. I think it's important for people to know that he did it because he believed that he could spark a confrontation between militias in the military and the federal government to purge Democrats from the federal government, take over federal buildings. I think that's important that we say, that we get out there so that we can grapple with it, not fetishize it, not, you know, constantly, you know, repeat his manifesto and things like that. But if we pretend like it doesn't exist, and I was kind of bothered by some of the media coverage of this guy that initially just went right to what law enforcement said, which is a tragic case of PTSD. Okay, it's possible that he had PTSD, but hold on a second. Like, what did he say? Oh, well, what he said is that he was hoping for his death to be a wake-up call to America so that the military and militias would march on Washington, seize government buildings, and purge Democrats by violence if necessary.
Yeah.
You can't, memory hole that. You can't memory hole that, especially in the week that is the anniversary of a storming of the U.S. Capitol by force, right?
Yeah.
You can't memory hole that. You shouldn't fetishize it, and you shouldn't be putting it out there for clicks. But you also have to say, hey, in addition to PTSD, this guy was saying things that have some pretty serious overlap with what a number of other people in society are saying is acceptable. And we need to grapple with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is that's a good point. That's yeah. And bringing that kind of information out into the public is going to help people. Well, it's going to give people a greater perspective of the issues that we're actually facing, because if people don't know people like that exist with those kind of beliefs, they're not going to see it as an issue or see it as a potential issue later on down the road.
Right. And I think so much of what we talk about is how do we help the people who are closest to vulnerable or disturbed people in our population? How do we get the people closest to them to intervene and act so that we can save their life and perhaps save the lives of other people? And I think, you know, there's a lot of talk sometimes about, like, in Colorado, it's red flag gun laws, right? You know, and what can, you know, prosecutors or police or this or that do or whatever if somebody is unstable and they have the means to inflict harm on themselves or others. But to me, the key part of the conversation is, what could you do to enable friends and family to feel like they can see warning signs, step in safely, and they can save lives through their actions? Because I don't think that we want a society where law enforcement is watching everybody all the time to figure out who they, you know, right, who they deem to be most dangerous. But we want family and friends to feel enabled on every level to be like, hey, my husband needs help. You know, my brother needs somebody to talk to. Like, he's spiraling, and, you know, and I just worry that we're headed to this point culturally where some of this spiral is encouraged by people. You know, lean into the conspiracies. They are out to get.
Yeah, like
they,
it's almost a, it's a mark of like, yeah, like, oh, finally, yes, you've woken up.
Yep.
It is dangerous, and I definitely agree with you there. It is, you know, it's hard to balance the knowledge of certain conspiracy theories that, you know, you can go on Wikipedia and find out about MKUltra and COINTELPRO and things like that, which are, you know, documented things. But then you have to realize that there's like a hierarchy of conspiracy theories where it's like, okay, you've got your bread and butter stuff down here, which, you know, there's like intelligible evidence that it occurs and has occurred in the past because it's well documented. And then you've got the stuff like, you know, Jewish space lasers or whatever, or like actually harmful things, you know, like politicians harvesting babies for life lengthening fluid or whatever they do. And yeah, I definitely see things getting worse before they get better, unfortunately, but I feel comforted in knowing that there are people like you and organizations like News9 doing their best to combat that.
Well, there's a lot of journalists around the country. And I would just say, you know, I think the future of journalism is local. I think the way that we combat the mistrust, a lot of it very earned with the media, is through accountability for ourselves, the same way that we demand accountability for others. And I think that the future of journalism is local, because those are the journalists that you know. They're not the ones who parachute into your community when something terrible happens and then leave the next day. We're here, right? You know, you're going to see me at the grocery store. You're going to see me at my kid's school. You know, you're going to see me at the brewery on the weekend or the Broncos game or whatever. And like, I want to have a conversation with you about what you believe and what's going right and wrong in your community. And at the end of the day, the truth matters, and the truth should matter to everybody, no matter where they stand on any issue. And the reason why is because lies and conspiracy theories and a lack of shared reality is super dangerous for all of us.
If you had one piece of advice to give to people, what would that be?
Challenge what you believe. If you challenge what you believe, then you're going to know if it's rock solid and it's rooted in reality. I mean, I do that as a journalist every day, where we'll say, we think there's a story here. And if you set out to prove that there is a story there, your brain will take the shortcuts that the brain can to get you to that point. If you say, I think there's a story there, but I'm going to set out to disprove to myself that there's a story there, and you still end up with it's a story, then there's a much better chance that it really is a story, that there's something there.
Yeah.
So, you know, and people can do that in any argument. You can do it around the house. You can do it when your wife tells you you're wrong. You know, you set out to disprove what you think. And if you end up in the same place, then you've strengthened your belief. Because if you just head down that greased rail, there's a good chance that you're going to miss stuff.
I think that's an excellent piece of advice that we could definitely practice far more than we do now as a general societal kind of thing. But yeah, I really appreciate you coming on, man. This was an excellent episode, and I think our listeners are going to get a lot out of it.
I appreciate the conversation. You know, my job is talking. I talk to a lot of people, but this has been a refreshingly different conversation. I really enjoyed it.
I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad.
People often say that for a gun podcast, we really don't talk about guns a lot.
We do with gun people, but you know, there. I think that you know, you really have to. We could ask you what your favorite looking gun is, or like if you're a gun owner, or yeah. what your personal views on guns are.
I find this other stuff a lot more interesting.
Yeah, you know, and we like to have people on who we respect as individuals, and then if the gun thing comes up, then that's a thing that we talk about, but. I think that you have a ton to provide the community, our community specifically, with the way that you conduct yourself and the practices that you exemplify. And that's, you know, that's first and foremost why we wanted to have you on. And this conversation just cemented that thought in my head. So I could not thank you enough for coming on today.
I appreciate the message that you spread that rights are for everybody because they are, whether you're talking about, you know, whether you're talking about firearms, whether you're talking about free speech, you know, but rights and responsibilities are for everyone, you know, and I think, you know, when we embrace that, you know, we'll be better off, and hopefully we can start to bust through some of this othering and some of this siloing and putting people in categories and, you know, we talk about what we have in common with our neighbors, right? Rights is a good place to start. You know, as Americans, we share rights, and that's something to be valued. And we also share responsibilities, and that's something to be taken seriously. So wherever that conversation starts on whatever issue, I'm happy to be a part of it. So I was glad to join you guys.
Heck yeah.